during this period of day, and it's usually all day and sometimes all weekend. So I'm always amazed when people are willing to do that. But what really floors me is when they come back after the first break. I just am always really amazed on that. So thank you all for being here and for coming back after the first break. As I said, before I start on the fourth step, and I'm all over the board this morning, and I'm sure that's the way that's okay, or it wouldn't be that way. I just wanted to mention something that kind of connects with the things I was talking about sanity, and that what goes in the record book is what I do. It's not what I think, feel, and believe, and yet there's this ego disorder of man, and at the very heart of that ego disorder is the conviction that what I think, feel, and believe is the center of the universe. Just, Lord, we can't have Donnie doing something he doesn't feel like doing. You know, we alcoholics are peculiar about being hypocrites. After we've done our inventory and so on, we can chuckle at past larceny and adultery. And if a homicide's far enough ago and we're never removed, we can get a tasteful little subtle lift of the corner of the mouth out of that. But by God, we don't want to be hypocrites. And that's so ingrained in me. That if I wake up and don't want to do the right thing in the morning, which maybe the right thing is go to work, every fiber of my being wants to do something like call one of you guys and aggravate you. I don't feel like going to work. What can I do to make me feel like going to work so I can go to work? Well, I'm going to give you guys some terrible news. I mean, this is crying towel stuff. In the 24 years that I've been sober, I have prayed my butt off trying to get God to make me feel like doing right so I can do right. I have aggravated sponsors to distraction trying to get me to feel right so I could do right. I have done enough written inventories that I'm sure that if I stacked them on the floor, they'd come somewhere between my knee and my hip trying to get me to feel right so I can do right. I've spent some little bit of money on outside counseling trying to get me to feel right so I can do right. And here's the awful news. Nothing has ever made me feel like doing right except going on doing right when I don't feel like it. And I just absolutely hate that. But what I want to talk about is words. Well, words are really important to me in sobriety. And one of the most important words is attitude. When I first came around, like everybody else, I kept hearing, make your attitude one of gratitude. If you don't get a good attitude, you're going to get drunk. Well, I'm scared to death because, man, the only definition I'd ever known of attitude was my mindset and the way I felt toward something. And how in the world am I going to flip a switch and change my mindset or the way I feel toward something? And these people telling me if I don't change it, I'm going to get drunk. I can't change it. Well, finally, Cherry, now old sponsor, and it aggravated me when he did this because it was clear that I was far smarter than Cherry. But the old fool told me, of all people, to go look in a dictionary. So he sent me to a particular dictionary to look up attitude. And the first definition of attitude had nothing on earth to do with what I thought or what I felt. It was a term from aviation and from geometry. And it was angle of approach. And I want to tell you, my angle of approach toward you or anything or anybody doesn't have a thing to do with what I feel about it or what I think about it. It's how I act toward it. Now, the magic of that was that the instant that I looked at that and the tumblers fell into place, my attitude went from something totally beyond my immediate control to something totally within my immediate control. And that helps me so much today to understand that my attitude, I'm not going to be able to flip switches and change what I think about something. I'm not going to be able to flip a switch and make me want to do it when I don't want to do it. But I can go ahead and do it anyway. If that spark of the divine in me knows that it's the next right stitch. And if I'm doing that, even if I'm thinking, this SOB will never stay sober, and he has worried me to death. He's worried everybody in Louisville to death. He calls at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning drunk, And what I really would like to do is tell him, why don't you just blow your brains out and save everybody the trouble of messing with you because you're hopeless like I was. But instead I say, yeah, Joe, how are you, buddy? What can I do for you? And I make the time available to Joe, even though all those feelings are swirling around in me. My attitude toward Joe is one of love and helpfulness. All those old crazy things swirling around in my mind and emotions don't have a thing to do with my attitude. My attitude is making that time for him. And Joe's mythical, by the way, is making that time for him, is speaking to him kindly and lovingly. So that's just been real important. But anyway, I don't know how I got off on that, but I did. But as I was leaving the room from having done the third step, Cherry told me I needed to get on that first step, fourth step at once. And I told you that, sure enough, 8 months later at once, I did. Now, I didn't know I waited 8 months to start working on my fourth step because I started thinking about it at once. I started running it through my head. And I would call up Cherry. I had to get things straight so before I sat down with a pencil and piece of paper and started writing, because we had movie rights and things to deal with here. And I wanted to get it all straight. So I'd call Cherry and start talking about some finer points of some parts of my inventory. And that old fool sounded like a parrot. Over and over, he would say, Don, it's impossible to start a fourth step without a pencil and a piece of paper and a big book open to page 64. And I'd try to explain some of these finer points to the old nut, and he'd come right back and say the same thing again. And, of course, with all my heart today, I believe we can't start a fourth step until we get a pencil and a piece of paper and a big book open to page 64. I have no quarrel with the forms that come out of treatment centers and that sort of thing. If you want to use them and they're helpful to you, by all means, go ahead. Me, I'm not going to try to improve on the big book deal. I can't imagine why I would try to improve on this book that has worked for so many millions of people and has worked so well for me in the past. By the way, part of Cherry's deal on recovering versus recovered is you don't do steps 1 through 9 but one time. You do steps 1 through 9 and you've done them. Now, the kicker in that is that everything in steps 1 through 9 is included in 10, 11, and 12. You see, every morning, part of my morning meditation is to read the third step prayer and to read the seventh step prayer. But in my mind, I'm not redoing my third step and I'm not redoing my seventh step. I'm doing 11th step work. So when I do an inventory, one of the reasons the 10th step is there is a safety net under our fourth step. Nobody ever did a perfect one. Now, we need to be searching and fearless and do the very best we can, and it needs to be conscientious, but we also need to make an end to it. We need to go ahead and get it done because, like everything else, it's better done than perfect. Because if I wait until perfect, it won't ever be done, and that 10th step is there. That squirrel caging running through my head, what's going on, that's not working on inventory. That's just what it is, it's squirrel caging. So finally I got it through my head that I would sit down and start the inventory with the pencil and a piece of paper, and I immediately ran into a terrible problem. Book says clearly that resentment's the number one offender. It kills more alcoholics than anything else, and I didn't have any. Didn't have any resentments. And I sat there for a couple of days, and I looked at that paper, and I said, well, I was right to start with. I've got mental problems much greater than alcoholism. Alcoholism is not my problem, not my main problem. I'd always suspected my alcoholism was just a result of my real problem, which we needed to address the real problem somewhere. Couldn't possibly be that simple as the alcoholism, the drug addiction being my real problem. Well, I prayed and I talked to some folks and a couple of things happened. Number one is that I came to understand that just because resentment is the number one offender overall among alcoholics, doesn't mean that resentment is the number one offender with every single individual alcoholic. In fact, I don't believe it is with me. And I think that has to do with my terrible degree of self-centeredness. I don't give anybody credit for being able to do much to me. I take credit and blame for everything that goes on without divine intervention. In fact, there's a joke about an alcoholic that was out in San Francisco during the great earthquake around 1900, And he woke up the morning after the earthquake, looked out the hotel window and said, "Oh my God, how am I ever going to pay for this one?" The other thing is that I was getting ahead of myself. I knew exactly that I was going to wind up needing to look at these things with only thoughts of where I was wrong, and disregarding the other person entirely. And a lot of my resentments were so silly, embarrassing, and clearly unjustified that they couldn't possibly be resentments. Like when I was doing that, first inventory, I hadn't seen my daughter. She hadn't talked to me in 2 years, something like that at that time. And I had destroyed that child's life. Y'all will learn tonight, I didn't have a pretty bottom. I didn't have a high bottom. I didn't have a private bottom. It was awful. And I destroyed that child's life. What kind of monster would be angry with a little 11-year-old girl reacting to all that for not wanting to see him? Well, when I got all those layers off of it, this kind of monster, because you see, I wasn't following the directions in the book. There are all sorts of little phases that I want to take a minute and go through. When we read the pages in the book, and they're only about 6 or 7 pages, page 64 to page 70, to do with the fourth step. And the first 100 times I read that, it was some sort of treatise or essay on doing an inventory. But I know now what it is a simple set of instructions. And if I'll go down and follow that, and the first instruction with regard to the resentment list, when I make that list, I make it in anger. And the book is absolutely clear. When I'm making that list, I'm to have absolutely no thought of where I may have been wrong. The book tells me it's my grudge list. It tells me I'm sore. It tells me I'm burned up. And when I got those layers off of it, yeah, resentment against every male that was over 6 feet was in fact a resentment, as silly as it was. Resentment against anybody that ever drove past an Ivy League university was in fact a resentment, you know, because it really was. And I did. I was furious that my daughter didn't want to see me, even though I knew I'd caused the whole situation. So once I understood and started following the directions like a little child and made the list, not thinking about where I was wrong at all, but rather what the dirty SOBs had done to me, it began to flow. Another thing, I had wanted to start with the first resentment I could remember, something about mama and a yardstick and some cookies, as I can remember. But if we look at what the directions are in the book says we went back through our lives. If I go back through my life, it's very clear. I start now, and I go back. And that flowed so much more easily. When the most recent resentment, which, as I recall, had something to do with some clown almost running over me, you know, where that the same day that I started it, and it just sort of cleared out of space around me, and it began to flow backwards. So when I followed the directions, it began to work. Also, I began to understand what Cherry meant. He had been telling me things like, "Don, this is not a new thing. You trying to take your inventory." He said, "For 37 years of your life, you have found no subject nearly as interesting as you." Said, "You have spent loads of time and energy trying to figure out what made you tick, trying to figure out what was wrong with you, and you've never been able to have any success doing it." Said, "Just because you hadn't had a drink for a little while does not mean that you have been given the power to take your inventory." Said, "You can't take your inventory." Said, "This thing is not the story of your life. This is not a psychological exercise. This is a spiritual exercise, and specifically it's an exercise in you following directions." Said, "What you do, you take every line of that book, and what it says do, you do it in the order that it says do it, and it'll work okay." I use the exact example that's on page 65 for a resentment list. And I'll give you just an insight into how literally I take this. You may have picked up, I fancy myself a little bit of a wordsmith. I've been fooling with words all my life. I like words. And I am absolutely convinced that there either ought not be a colon after "I'm resentful at and affects my," or there ought to also be a colon after "the cause." I'm convinced of that. But when I do this, I put a colon after I'm resentful at and a colon after affects mine. I do not put a colon after the cause, because that's the way it is in the book. I don't see any reason in the world why those should be italicized. But when I do that, I underline those things when I do it. I try to truly come like a little child and let God, through the book, do what I can't do. I can't take my inventory, but God, through this book, will take my inventory if I'll come to it like a little child and simply follow the directions. There are three distinct freestanding parts of the four-step Alcoholics Anonymous. There's the resentment list, and sometimes if you're around discussion meetings, you'll get the idea that the resentment list is all there is to doing the fourth step of Alcoholics Anonymous. Just like you'll get the idea that doing the fourth and fifth step is all there is to doing the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'll talk about that more in a minute. Not only are there three freestanding parts, if you remove the example of the resentment list on page 65, the book devotes more words to the sexual inventory than it does the resentment list. And you rarely hear the sexual inventory talked about in discussion meetings. There's probably a good reason for that. These things shouldn't be talked about probably in discussion meetings, but it ought to be acknowledged that it's a very important part of the third step of Alcoholics Anonymous. The fear list, of course, is the third part of the inventory, and the book could not be more clear. We listed our fears, whether or not they were related to a resentment. Absolutely freestanding part of the inventory. there are some parts of it where we don't write. The book says the first thing we do is make that resentment list in anger. Then we go back and we look at that list and see how it controls us. And then we go back and we forgive every person, institution, and principle on that list before we've even looked at where we are wrong. Now, that one, of course, threw me for a loop. I can't forgive all these things. I can't ever forgive some of these things. Same old deal. They told me, said, Don, you're back into your dang feelings again. Said, there is a specific forgiveness process in this book. It's written out on pages 66 and 67. It tells you precisely what to do to look at every entry on that list, see how your resentments have got to be mastered, think that this is perhaps a spiritually sick person, and we ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. Even has a prayer in parentheses. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, this is a sick man, how can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry, thy will be done. That's forgiveness prayer from the fourth step of Alcoholics Anonymous. Once I have done that, specifically with regard to every entry on the list, it doesn't say, and wait until you feel like all resentment is gone and then go on. No, I do those actions. And you know, the actions of forgiveness, that was one of the most powerful lessons I ever learned. There's a history with my daughter of sexual abuse, of really bad sexual abuse by a family member over a long period of time in her childhood from 4 to 11. And I didn't find out about that until after I was sober, which was years after it was over with. And about 10 or 12 years ago, a person involved in that abuse was laying on what everybody, including the doctors, thought was a deathbed, and they called for me. They wanted me to come there. And I said, I couldn't. It felt disloyal to my child. It felt hypocritical. It just felt like I could not do that. And I told my friends and my sponsor, you know, I can't forgive that. You know, I can't do that. And finally, after praying and talking to folks, it got through to me. After every AA meeting, or practically every AA meeting that I go to, I know some areas we're closing with the Serenity Prayer now, but most of them that I go to still close with the Lord's Prayer. I hold somebody's hands, and I ask God to forgive me by precisely the same standard that I forgive other people. Just by precisely the same standard. And it occurred to me that if I say I'm going to be a real good guy and generous and forgiving, up to this point, But damn you, if you step a toe across that point, I'll not try to forgive you because I've drawn that line in the sand. I'm inviting God to draw the line in the sand for me. And God may not draw the line in the sand the same place I thought the line ought to be drawn. And I'm too far gone to put any restrictions on my God's forgiveness of me. And then I was hit with the problem of hypocrisy. How can I go down to that bed feeling like I'm feeling? And a very wise person said to me, said, Don, let me tell you something. God feeling like God has forgiven you would be nice, but it doesn't make a bit of difference. Said, God can either be thinking, oh, Don's a good boy, and I'm so glad he's straightened up now, and I feel so forgiving about everything. And that'll be wonderful. But if God says, that little SOB, I don't think I've ever had anybody that pisses me off as much as Don Major does, and I'd like to squish his butt like a bug, and I ought to, but after all, I'm God, and I got to act like God, and I got to act like I forgive the little clown, I will get exactly the same thing as if God had felt the other way. So you see, if I act out forgiveness, even though I don't feel it yet in my heart and in my mind, and my God gives me precisely what I've given to my fellow man, then I'll be just fine. I went down that bed and did that. I'm not going to tell you it's easy. It was not easy. And over the years, I want to tell you that pain is almost gone. That pain, the pain of the resentment about it is almost gone. So the action of resentment is what it's talking about. Then the action of forgiveness. After I've taken the action of forgiveness by following those simple directions right there in the book, then I move on to the next step. That's where I refer back to my list, and that's where I get my pencil and piece of paper out again. That's where I use the checklist on page 67, clear checklist, says where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, or frightened, though a situation not entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. Where were we to blame? When we saw our faults, we listed them. We placed them before us in black and white. And by the way, that's a literary trick that Bill Wilson uses all the time. If something's really important, he'll tell you the same thing two or three times in a row in different language. Like here he says, we listed them. We placed them before us in black and white. Wants to make sure that we understand that we talk about writing this down, not sitting around thinking about it. Now, over the years, I've sponsored a number of people who have a problem with reading and writing. A couple or three, the problem was actually visual. You know, they did not have enough sight in order to do that. Many more, there's been a literacy problem so that they, you know, just literally could not read and comprehend this book, and they couldn't put down on a piece of paper what they need to put down. I found out that for those people, doing it on tape seems to work just beautifully. But I also believe strongly that those of us who can read and write need to, I can read and write, and I need to do exactly like this book says. I don't need to start improving. I don't need to start making exceptions. I need to do exactly what this book says do, the way the book says do it, if it's physically possible for me to do that. But if a person can't read and write, I've found out in my experience that the taping works just beautifully on the deal. Once we've done that, and of course at that point, we have turned it around 180 degrees. When we make that list in anger, we have no thought of where we might be wrong. When we're doing this last part that we just read in this last writing, we have no thought of where the other person is wrong. We give no consideration to where they're wrong. We resolutely look for where we are wrong. We use that checklist. And any flaws in addition to that we see, we set them before us in black and white. We list them. When we do that, we finish the resentment list, the first third of the fourth step of Alcoholics Anonymous. Then we go to the fear list, and Bill talks about fear being maybe worse than stealing, and there's no question fear has caused me a whole bunch more problems stealing. In fact, I've been a criminal defense lawyer all my life. Other people's stealing has been right profitable for my part. But fear is my enemy. As I said, I don't think resentment's my number one offender. I really think fear is. I've been terrified all my life. When without divine intervention, terror is my monster today. It says we list our fears. We write here. We put them down on paper. It doesn't indicate that we have to do anything other than just list them. You know, that we just don't necessarily write out why our thing. And now, a lot of my fears were too silly or too embarrassing to put down on paper, and they couldn't possibly have been related to anything. Like, you know, I have not so much. I do have a really terrible phobia about snakes, but I also, I'm not real crazy about graveyards and dead people, And I know there are not any vampires and werewolves, but, you know, ought not take a whole lot of chances on that, I don't guess. You know, I've always been kind of afraid that maybe my masculine equipment didn't measure up real well, and who'd want to put that down, you know, and admit that that was a fear? And who would want to admit that there were times in your youth when you were afraid you'd look at a person of the same sex and have a sexual urge toward that person? You know, who wants to put down embarrassing fears like that? You know, those are the ones that belong down there. There's no fear too silly. There's no fear embarrassing. If it's a fear, I need to put it down there. And then we move on to the sexual, and no, the fear prayer. It tells us what to do. It says that we ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention to what God would have us be. And then we get a little promise there. It says that once we commence to outgrow fear. Now, that doesn't say that any fear is going to fall away from us immediately there. And I do have less fear, and I deal with my fear better than I did years ago, and it continues to get better. Just because it's been so helpful to me, I want to throw this in. Over the years, I have refined my fear prayer, and let me tell you why and how. For the first couple, 3 years I was sober, I would lay on a sofa and, God, please remove my fear so I can go do this thing that I'm scared of doing that I know I need to face. God, please remove my fear. And then I'd go talk to my sponsor. Then I'd go dominate a discussion meeting. Then I'd do me another inventory on what it was I was afraid of that I had to sometimes go get me a counselor, pay him $80 or $100 an hour, you know, talk to me about getting over this fear so I can do this thing. And I found out that a more effective prayer for me is, God, please give me the strength to act in spite of my fear. And what I found out is that God doesn't remove those fears while I'm laying on the sofa praying about it. God removed those fears when I pray on my knees and get up off my knees and start walking toward the fear. Start walking toward the fear while my insides still feel like jelly and while my palms are sweating, my knees are shaking. That's when my prayers are answered. That's when, and what caused me to do that, I was whining about God needing to remove some fear on something one time, and some clown said, Don, if you are hungry and lock yourself in a closet and pray for a hot dog, you think one's going to come squirting through the keyhole? He said, you pray, but you get out and around somewhere where they got food, you know, when you do it, and that's it. I need to understand that when God removes my fear is after I start taking the action of walking toward that fear. Then we get to the sexual inventory. Like I said, Bill devotes a lot of words to the sexual inventory. It's the most forward-looking part of the inventory. It discusses very much, you know, what we need to do in the future in order to shape our behavior in that regard in the future. And also, probably a third of the words that Bill uses in talking about sex is, quit making such a big deal about this. Quit being so hysterical. Now, some people sometimes misunderstand and think I'm talking about a license for bad sexual behavior. I'm not talking about that at all. What I am saying is that we need, just like the book says, to treat it like any other problem. You know, and we will, you know. Maybe we're not telling Uncle Sam about everything we make, you know, if we're in some kind of business where there might be a 20 or a 50 here somewhere that slips through. Maybe we're not getting it all down. And you know, we'll mention it to the sponsor. I really ought to straighten that out. Or maybe we've got an expense account that we're a little too generous on or something like that. We think about those things and they bother us a little bit. But we go right on. But my God, if we make a misstep sexually, oh, the world's going to come to an end. You know, it's just the end of the world. Bill over and over tells us, hey, only God can judge our sexual situation. And treat this like everything else. They specifically address on page 70, what if we fall short in the sexual area and we stumble? Does it mean we're going to get drunk? Not necessarily, the book says. It says, if we are sorry for what we have done, we'll be forgiven and go on. We'll be forgiven, we'll be all right. It also does say, if we are not sorry and our behavior continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. And then Bill adds, we are not theorizing. These are facts out of our own experience. And Bill may have been talking about some quite personal experience there. I don't know for sure, but he certainly may have been. But we just need to treat it like anything else. And I need not to judge anybody else's sexual situation. It's none of my damn business what anybody else is doing in that regard. There are cultures that have a completely different view on sex than what we do on the face of this earth. And Alcoholics Anonymous works in those cultures. as far as the writing goes, the book is very clear that I make a list of all the situations that I can think of, that I can remember, the sexual situations. Now, two things about that. For some people, there have to be categories. I mean, let's face it, we're alcoholics, and some of us don't remember every one-night stand we ever had. Some of us have been on one side or the other of a lot of prostitution arrangements and obviously can't remember every one of those. And it's fine, what we can't remember, to lump it in as a category. Now, the other thing about that is, there are a lot of things that wound up on my sex list where I never actually had sex or maybe any sexual contact of any kind with the person. The reason for that is that some of my very tackiest efforts were not fruitful. so it's, was I motivated that way? And then we've got a checklist on this, the middle paragraph in page 69. We reviewed our conduct over the years past, and I just make a checklist out of this. I write it out, where had we been selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate, who had I hurt, did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness, where was I at fault, what should I have done instead, and just in case you hadn't got the point, Bill says we got this all down on paper and looked at it. So it's very clear that we write that and we do it that way. And then Bill goes back to talking about the future. He says, in the future, we use a very simple test. Is it selfish or not? Now, that can be tricky with regard to sex, because I want to tell you something. Sex feels good. Sexual relationships feel good. It's an area of life where we have some of our greatest pleasure and where we have some of our greatest despair. But just because it feels good to us does not mean it's selfish. You know, just because we make money out of a business deal doesn't mean we're being dishonest or we're cheating. And we need to apply that same standard to sexual behavior. Are we misleading somebody? Are we betraying somebody? Just the same standard we would as if it were business is what we need to apply there as to whether it's selfish or not. He talks a while longer about, you know, avoid the hysteria. Our sex powers are God-given and neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. We treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer can come. God alone can judge our situation. And then we have the sex prayer, which is the middle of page 70. And I've spent a lot of time sober, single. So I had this prayer for years was part of my morning prayers. We earnestly pray for the right ideal. Lord, did I ever need the right ideal? When I got in here, I had no idea on earth what right sexual behavior was. For guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, and for the strength to do the right thing. And then it says, if sex is very troublesome, just like anything else, what we do is throw ourselves into helping others, and that will quiet the imperious urge when nothing else would. So again, treat it like anything else. And once we've done that, we've done the fourth step of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, fifth step, we are not told who to take it with. Of course, the time this book was written, nobody even gave a thought to the possibility that you might take it with another alcoholic. If you read the book, it point blank tells you if you're Catholic, you're going to do it with a priest. It says that if you belong to a denomination which requires confession, you will, of course, have to and want to do it with the appropriate person there. Now, I point that out to Catholic sponsees, but I never, you know, if they want to go ahead and do their fifth step with me, I go ahead and listen to their fifth step, you know, but it's in there. I'm not Catholic myself, so it wasn't appropriate to me. Do we do it with our sponsor? As a practical matter, today we do. The word sponsor is not even mentioned in the first 164 pages of the big book. But as a practical matter, today we do most of the time, and I think that's fine. Some questions arise about it. Mechanically, how do you do it? I've only found three ways. That's for the number one, the person who's done the inventory to hold it and read it and comment, and the person that's listening to it comment and ask questions. Number two, for the person that's done the inventory to paraphrase it and do the same thing. Number three, for both of them to sit there and look at it and read it to themselves, and each of them asking, clarifying, whatever. I've never found one of the three ways to be any better. Now, by the way, length of fourth steps. I've listened to fourth steps that were on one piece of paper, and I have listened to fourth steps that were in two full, large briefcases. And I don't know that length has much to do with the effectiveness or the value of the fourth step at all. Of the three ways to do the fifth step, the third one is faster. The two briefcase one, and I have full authority to talk about this. My dear friend and sponsee, John from South Dakota, called me up it was 12 and a half years ago, because he just turned 20 years sober and he was 7.5 years sober. And he'd heard my tapes. We'd never met. He'd heard my tapes, said, "I haven't been able to find anybody that I felt like was appropriate to do my fifth step. I've been listening to your tapes and I think you're the man. Can I come to Louisville and do my fifth step with you?" And I said, "Well, have at it, partner." So we found a weekend, and I went and met him at the airport. And so this big cowboy comes out with a big cowboy hat, what I thought was two suitcases. Nah. That's the fourth step. We spent 27 hours that weekend going through it. And believe me, if we hadn't gone to that third method of both looking at it and reading it to ourselves, we would never have gotten through it. The fifth step is a three-part step. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being. I don't believe the other two parts would have been in there if I weren't supposed to recognize those parts. Now, I've never felt it necessary to stand in front of a mirror and read a whole fourth step. I've never felt it necessary to get on my knees and read the whole fourth step to God. But to me, it is very important to make an acknowledgement of that. What works for me is to stand in front of a mirror and say, you know, there it is. That's the best you can do. Try not to hide from yourself, partner, because there you are. And do a similar thing by getting on my knees and say, "God, I know you know me a whole lot better than I do. And I know that even though I'm promising you I'm going to try not to deny all this, I know I will. But for this moment, I really want to try to just admit to you that it's best I tell that's what's there." And that's important to me because I've complied with the directions. I've followed the dot. I've got something that I can remember that, yes, I stood in front of that mirror and I admitted it to myself. I got on my knees and I admitted it to God. And those things are important to me, to be able to know that I followed the directions. Do you do your fifth step all with one person? The book is a little bit ambiguous on that. It's probably a good idea. And by the way, all the concern about confidentiality on fifth steps, and you do need to use common sense. You don't need to take some clown that just got out of the asylum last week and admit seven murders to him, you know. But I've heard very, very few mentions of anybody breaking a confidence in a fifth step. It's a very rare thing. If you've chosen somebody who's truly in recovery and has done the steps themselves, it's not apt to happen. Because I'm a lawyer, a number of times, I have people come to me and want to do a fifth step or part of their fifth step with me because it involves some things that could create some legal problems for them. In fact, sometimes big-time legal problems. And I explain to them that it may or may not be legally effective, and I let them give me a dollar as a retainer, and I sit there and listen to them. And if they need to do that, I suppose that's all right. What if the person you've done your fifth step with dies? Do you need to do it with somebody else? Book doesn't give us any guidance on that, and I can just tell you, my experience and my feeling is that I want one living human being walking this earth that knows everything bad about me that I know to tell them. So I've had the experience of a sponsor dying, and I did feel like I needed to do another fifth step with someone else who was living. So that was my choice on it. What about listening to a fifth step? Not a thing in the book about it. Not a word. I think there's some good reasons they're not a word. Number one is, when the book was written, it wasn't contemplated that we were going to be doing them with one another. Number two, I don't think there's much to do. I'm a sponsor. I'm not a counselor. You know, when my 99% of my function in listening to a fifth step is, in fact, to listen. Now, that doesn't mean that I always sit there like a bump on a log. What I do is I say the prayers that cause the miracle for me. You see, by nature, without divine intervention, I am not a listener. By nature, without divine intervention, my brain's going to be running off on something very frequently, what I'm going to say next while you're talking to me. But if I'll use those 11th step prayers and run through my head, that will be done. I'm no longer running the show. And, Lord, please let me seek to love, comfort, and understand rather than to be loved, comforted, and understood. The miracle happens. God makes me a listener, and I'm truly listening to that person instead of thinking about something else. And then I kind of take the next stitch. If something feels right in my heart, and it's usually something of sharing with the person when you can tell they're having trouble, they're getting to a part that's difficult for them, of sharing a similar thing out of my own experience or something that'll make them feel better. Did I ever send anybody back and tell them this is not right, do your fourth step over? No, not in those words. But I have pointed out, you know, you haven't done this in the form that the book says do it and the way the book says do it. And I need to do it that way. Now, I'm happy to go ahead and listen to your fifth step you got here, but I would need to go back also and try to put it in the form the book says do it. And then I let it go with that, because I'm not a teacher and I don't make the rules here. You know, I never refuse anybody that asks me to sponsor them. I put some qualifications on it by letting them know I don't have a bunch of time and that sort of thing, and let them know that it'll be their job to call me, that if they're going to get mad because I don't run them down when I don't hear from them for 2 or 3 weeks, they don't need me for a sponsor. If they're new, I tell them they need to get somebody else also, whether they call them a sponsor or not, that they can get in their pocket if necessary, because I'm just honest, I don't have an empty pocket. You know, I simply don't. I'm out of town a bunch. I'm busy as the devil, and I can't. You know, if all the new guys that are talking to me at one time jumped in my pocket, I'd have to quit work. You know, and I still wouldn't have enough time for them. So I do that. After you've done the fifth step, the book couldn't be more clear. It tells you exactly where to go, what to do, how long to take. It says that you go home, that you take the book down from the shelf, big book. You spend 1 hour reviewing the first 5 steps, trying to make sure that you haven't skimped on anything, haven't, you know, shortchanged yourself. So once you've done that, then you move on to steps 6 and 7. And the big book devotes a great big whopping almost half page to steps 6 and 7, the top of page 76. And the way I read it, you go on and do that 7th step prayer by yourself after you've gone home that day from doing the 5th step. If you feel like you're ready, you go ahead and do it. And that's what I did. And I want to tell you that to me, the 6th and 7th step seemed clear. Seemed really that Bill Wilson had kind of used it as filler so he'd have 12, because that's sort of a mystical number, you know, and a good round number, have 12 steps. And I thought 6 and 7 were where, with God's help, I'd gotten that far. I went to work on me to make me into what I had decided a spiritual Don ought to be. Because, you see, when I did my 4th and 5th step, I did that. I pretty well formed a picture of what a spiritual Don ought to be. So, for the next 9 years, or for the next 8 years, until I was 9 years sober, because I was about a year sober when I was doing this, not quite, but about, that's what I did. And I want to tell you, those first 9 years of sobriety, in many ways, were absolutely magic. You know, I got to, and y'all will hear my story tonight, but I found that non-alcoholics are so beautifully forgiving when we try to do the right thing. You know, and it's just been so much magic. The child that I didn't see in total, I didn't see her for more than another year after I was doing this inventory. Didn't see or talk to for over 3 years, wound up moving in with me and living with me all through high school. And she and I are dear friends. She's 37 years old and been in Al-Anon way over 20 years, and we're just dear friends. Now, we also can get on one another's nerves bad enough to make the other one break out in the hives. I don't want to paint any unrealistic pictures here, but from no relationship at all to the warm relationship that we have is just light years. It's just beautiful. So I saw her right away, and she moved in with me. As a result of steps 8 and 9, my law license got put back in order. Of course, they jerked my law license, and as you'll find out tonight, I'd lived on the street for almost a year and a half. Everybody thought, including me, assumed I would die of alcoholism and drug addiction. Started making a little money, and next thing you know, I'm driving a decent car, wearing decent clothes, and by God incidents, when I was 22 months sober, I wound up talking at the Kentucky State Convention in front of 2,000 people, and people started saying nice things to me. Will you be my sponsor? Will you talk here? Will you talk there? And those first 9 years were wonderful, except certain things, primarily financial situations and relationships with the opposite sex, like to have killed me the first 9 years I was sober. And what I was doing, whatever character defects were making my self-centered butt uncomfortable and embarrassing me and were inconsistent with this little picture of a spiritual Don I had in my head, I would grab those suckers by the collar and I would use rigorous honesty, steps, prayer, sponsors, outside counseling, and I'd slam them up against the wall and I'd say, "Come here, God, give me a little help, we'll get rid of this thing." And God never showed up. Now, y'all may have picked up this morning that in the right circumstances, maybe just a tiny little bit, I could be capable of the least little bit of grandiosity. I kind of had in my head, I was like Moses, you know, and God had walked me the promised land, said, "You know, I let you live. I can't really figure out why, but I did. I let you live, and I'm letting you enjoy some things and have an opportunity to try to help other people, but I want you to look down there at those people living sane lives financially and in their relationship life. You didn't really think I was going to let you get away with all that crap, did you, Don?" Said, "You know, it's like Moses in the promised land. You can look at that, but you ain't having any of it." Something happened in May of 1990, and I'm not going to belabor it. I'm going to wind us up here in 15 minutes, and we're going to quit on time. But my first sponsor had died, and I wound up with a new sponsor up in Cleveland, Tom B. from up around there. And I flew up there to spend a weekend with Tom in May of 1990, and I was dying. I mean, I was just dying. It's embarrassing speaking at conferences all over the country and just dying inside, you know, and just more money I made, the worse my financial picture would get, and I was acting like a 13-year-old. I wasn't lying to a soul. Every time I looked one in the eye and said, "I love you forever," I meant it with all my heart. And I couldn't help it that 10 days later I'd wake up and think, "If I don't get away from this woman, I'm going to die." You know, I couldn't help that. That was just what was going on. Tom had told the guys up in Cleveland, and the weekend I was up there, there was a Cleveland-Akron golf tournament. And Tom had been sober 29 years at the time. This was May of 1990. And these guys treated him like a newcomer. There was one old boy there I met that weekend who had drank with Dr. Bob. And I didn't get out of the airport before one of them said, oh, sober about 9 or 10 years, said that's about the time most folks start to look at steps 6 and 7. And I thought, well, you don't know who you're talking to. You know, by that time I'd listened to something between 50 and 100 fifth steps and talking all over the country. And by the time I left there that weekend, I was beginning to know what he was talking about. And let me make this clear. You don't have to wait until you're sober 9 or 10 years to look at the 6th and 7th step the right way. It's just that if you blow past them like I do, that's about the time most of us flat hit the brick wall and have to either do something about it or die. But you can do it at any time. Now, that weekend is a burning bush to me. But I want to talk to you all about burning bushes for just a minute. I have never seen a burning bush in full conflagration. I've seen a whole bunch of smoking bushes. I've probably seen 1,000 smoking bushes in my life. I can't remember but 3 or 4 of them. And the reason I can't is I had one of those moments that we all, man, God, that's life-changing. That's it. That's it. That's the key, man. I don't do anything about it. 2 weeks later, I don't even remember it. It makes no difference in my life. The bushes that have made a difference in my life are the ones where I saw a smoking bush, and I went and got my bellows, and I started giving that sucker air, and I started fanning it. And I let it become a burning bush in my life. Now, we're right back to hypocrisy. Let me explain this to you the way I see it. Bill Wilson laid in a hospital bed when he was shaking out his last drunk. And something happened that caused old Bill to see a flash of light of some kind. It's very clear that Bill didn't have a clue what that was. He didn't know whether it was an angel from on high or whether it was his synapses misfiring coming off the booze. The next morning, Dr. Silkworth came in and Bill told him exactly that. He said, this happened, I don't have a clue what it was. Dr. Silkworth said, and most of y'all know what he said. He said, I don't know either, Bill. But if I were you, I would hold on to it because it's got to be better than what you had. Bill Wilson got out his bellows. And he started fanning that smoking bush, and that's why we're here this morning. That's why Alcoholics Anonymous exists. So I need to remember that I've got a part in my own awakenings, in my own epiphanies. Things have about as much importance in my life as I act out that they have. So it took a while for it to become clear how important that weekend is, but let me talk to you about the things that changed for me as a result of that weekend. I understood I had step 6 and 7 completely wrong. The 7th step prayer, and back to words. All my life, if I told you I know something or realize something, it was synonymous. It meant the same thing. Not even close. Realize is a form of the word real. When I have realized something, that means that it literally has become real inside me. And the stuff I've known for 30 years that I haven't realized. You see, I could have quoted the 7th step prayer to you backwards. If you had given me 5 minutes and sat down at a table with me, I could have started at the last word of the 7th step prayer and worked backwards to the first word as far as knowing it. But somehow I missed the fact that that prayer means it when it doesn't ask God to remove all my defects of character. And it certainly doesn't ask God to remove the ones that are making my self-centered butt uncomfortable. And it certainly doesn't ask God to remove the ones that are inconsistent with my little picture of a spiritual Don. You see, just because I had dressed that up in spiritual clothing, for 9 years I couldn't recognize that it was a self-determined objective. It was no different than me deciding that I needed to be and ought to be chairman of General Motors and starting out to do that. And for me to pray for a character defect to be gone because I want it gone, because it's making me uncomfortable, because it's embarrassing me, is the same spiritual mistake as praying for a bright red Ferrari. I'm praying for my own selfish ends, and the book tells me it doesn't work. You can easily see why. It took me 9 years to easily see why. Because you see, and I don't quarrel with people that say that Alcoholics Anonymous is a selfish program. I understand their point, and it's a good point that they're making, that we have to take care of our sobriety or we're no good to anybody. But I want to tell you something. My illness is selfishness and self-centeredness. It couldn't be clearer. And I've tried every way in the world to successfully treat it with obsession on self. I've dressed obsession with self up in spiritual clothing. I've dressed obsession with self up in psychological clothing because, man, I love to obsess on Don. And it just seems like there ought to be some way to treat my alcoholism by obsessing on me. But it's just like trying to put out a fire with gasoline. I can't do it. All the steps tell you. Third step prayer. Take away my difficulties. Not so and stay sober. Not so and be spiritual or comfortable. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of their power, their love, and their way of life. The seventh step prayer. Remove each and every defect or every single defect of character that stands in the way of usefulness to my God and my fellows. The ninth step says, yeah, we're trying to put our lives in order, but that's not our real purpose. It says the real purpose of the ninth step is to fit us to be of maximum service to God and those around us. It's everywhere. We can't treat this deal by working on us. We've got an illness that is self-centeredness, and our solution is God and other people. I believe with Chuck Chamberlain's philosophy with all my heart, I believe that it's not my job to take care of me. That's God's job. It's my job to help God's kids do what they need to have done for free and for fun because I want to, and God will take care of me, and it works that way. And you know, I said that I thought that it was where I went to work on me with God's help. The 12 and 12, by the way, and the 12 and 12 is good on the 6th and 7th step. I'm not a big fan of the 12 and 12. It's fine. It's wonderful. It's wonderful thoughts from Bill Wilson. I am always aware when I'm reading the 12 and 12 that when Bill wrote the big book, I believe he was inspired by God. When Bill wrote the 12 and 12, he was being sponsored by a psychiatrist, and I think there's a little difference there. But the 12 and 12 is very good on step 6 and 7. And it says this is the step that separates the adults from the children. And it tells us that what separates the adults from the children is the willingness to give up all of our self-determined objectives for the perfect objective of God that we can never know. So, you see, the 12 and 12 also quotes another big old book that is not conference-approved material. And the big book refers to it in Bill's story. In saying, of myself I am nothing, the Father does the work. Well, for 9 years my brain edited that to read, of myself I'm not enough, and I have to have some help from God. And that's not what it says. It says, of myself I'm nothing, the Father does the work. I can't any more effectively work on any of my defects of character than I was able to effectively work on drinking and taking dope. It still is based on grace. It's not based on merit. Now, I have to reaffirm my third step. I have to reaffirm that I'm going to try real hard to do the next right thing because neither God nor you guys are ever going to knock a drink out of my hand. You know, I can't abdicate the responsibility for what I put in my body. I can't abdicate the responsibility for my behavior to you guys or to God. But if I'll take that stitch, if I'll just do that next right thing and quit trying to figure out the pattern, I've found out that my God takes care of it. You see, my problem with perfection wound up not being what I'd thought it was all my life. I thought my problem with perfection was my inability to attain perfection. I, of course, am unable to attain perfection, but that has never mattered. It never gets that far. I am unable to recognize perfection. You see, if God gave me the power to become anything on earth that I thought I ought to be right now, I'd be like a blind dog in a butcher shop. I'd have no idea who and what I'm supposed to be. So I started stumbling that way back in May of 1990, and I've told you all how I stumble, you know, and fall so much during the day and get up. The way it's worked is just absolutely embarrassing. The blessings that God has put on me are embarrassing. The Bar Association that kicked me out so loudly has given me honors that are just embarrassing. They're crazy. Last year, the president of the state bar called me and said, Don, we've got a vacancy on the ethics committee. My God, the first 10 years I practiced law, the only people I was more afraid of than the state ethics committee were the IRS and the FBI. And they put me on the ethics committee. I found peace in my life from a financial standpoint. I found peace from the relationship standpoint. All from quitting trying to fix things. All from trying to come as a little child and just keep stumbling that next right thing and let God make of me what God would care to make of me, letting go of the patterns. I can't tell you how it's worked in my life, and it's just beautiful. And I so much appreciate you guys. Let's see if there's anything. Oh, don't stop after steps 5 and 6, please, or 4 and 5 or 6 and 7. I can't tell you how many people over the years have called me and said, you know, I did my inventory and I did my 5th step 2 months ago or 4 years ago, and things are not better, they're worse. And invariably, when I start cross-examining them about whether they have gone and finished the rest of the first 9 steps, the answer with those people is no. And that's what the answer is. They're where they're supposed to be, because 4 and 5 don't heal a thing. 4 and 5 simply dig up a bunch of rotting corpses we have had stamped down in the earth, but we've had them stamped down. 4 and 5 dig them up and throw them all around our lives. It's 6, 7, 8, and 9 that rebury them properly. So if you stop after 4 and 5, the probabilities are where we are going to wind up is less comfortable than if we had never done a 4th and 5th step at all. So I just really thank you. I can't tell you how great it is to be asked to come up and do this. And I hope that God will bless us and that some of us will get something out of what we did this morning. Thank you. And it's pretty damn, it's usually all day and sometimes all weekend. So I'm always amazed when people are willing to do that. But what really floors me is when they come back after the first break. I just am always really amazed on that. So thank you all for being here and for coming back after the first break. As I said, before I start on the 4th step, and I'm all over the board this morning, and I'm sure that's the way that's okay, or it wouldn't be that way. I just wanted to mention something that kind of connects with,